To all who come to this happy place, welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome once again to the official Disneyland Resort podcast, a unique look at the magical moments and events here at the place where dreams come true. Join us each month as we celebrate the Year of a Million Dreams with a behind-the-scenes look at what's new and exciting here at the Disneyland Resort. And now, here is your host, Michael Gohagan.
This is your spot, Walt. Take it away.
To open the first operative monorail system in America, it is our good fortune to have our friend and fellow Californian, the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Richard Nixon, and his charming family, Mrs. Pat Nixon, Julia, and Patricia, his daughters. Mr. Nixon?
Now, of course, comes the time for the dedication, and although you and I, the adults up here, are probably just as interested in riding in this as the children, since this first monorail system is a system for the future, and since, of course, Disneyland is a place which children love above everybody else, I think it would be nice if our two daughters, Patricia and Julie, would cut this ribbon.
Here, children. Now, you know how to cut a ribbon, don't you?
Huh?
Go right up there. Let her go!
With that ceremony in June of 1959, a new era in public transportation was born. The Disneyland monorail was the first daily operating monorail system in the Western Hemisphere. Now, nearly 50 years later, this iconic attraction is getting a sleek new look that will celebrate its past while leading the way into the future. In this edition of the Disneyland Resort podcast, we'll chat with the man known as Mr. Monorail, Disney legend Bob Gurr, and get his perspectives and recollections on working with Walt Disney on the very first monorail project. Then it's off to the Disneyland Monorail Station as we give you a sneak peek of the brand new Mark 7 monorail with Imagineer Scott Drake. Ever wonder who's behind that booming voice you hear making all the daily announcements in the parks? Well, it's Bill Rogers, and we'll visit with him to find out about the history of the voice of Disneyland. Now, as a train aficionado, Walt Disney was fascinated by the futuristic rocket ship design of the monorail. In fact, he envisioned it to be the transportation of the future. And what better place to showcase this amazing vehicle than here at Disneyland? In 1958, Walt decided to put his plan in motion and turned to 23-year-old engineer Bob Gurr to come up with the design. Gurr consulted with teams of engineers in both Burbank and in Germany, going through design after design, laboring to create the perfect vehicle. Nearly 50 years later, Bob Gurr is known as one of Disney's most celebrated Imagineers, having worked on more than 100 different attractions throughout his Disney career. We took off with Bob for a nostalgic ride aboard the Disneyland monorail. He told us what went into creating this iconic attraction.
Hello, everyone. Welcome aboard the Disneyland monorail. We are now beginning a 2.5-mile journey to downtown Disney Station and back for a safe trip.
So I'm joined now by Bob Gurr. So first of all, Bob, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to do this podcast for you in really and live and right in the nose of the monorail.
Well, that's right. We're here in the nose of the monorail. Why don't you tell everybody, you're kind of you have a special relationship with the monorail.
Yes, I sometimes enjoy when people say, Bob, what is your real name? And I say, well, it's Mr. Monorail. And the reason for that is this is Disneyland Monorail System represents the first daily operating monorail system in America. And that was something Walt really wanted to have. In fact, if you go look at the Herb Ryman drawing that Walt had Herb do in order to raise the money to even build Disneyland, in the lower right-hand side of that picture is a little monorail. It's actually a hanging type of design, which was well-known at that time. A French company, Seiffage, made a train like that. So you can see that Walt's original thoughts of Disneyland did include a monorail. But it wasn't until 1958 that he and Lily, his wife, were driving in Germany near Cologne, and on the road in front of them, crossing the road through the trees, was a monorail. But a type of monorail like this train, where the monorail sits on top of a beamway. Anyway, he went over to the monorail where it went, and he didn't speak German, and the people suggested he go back across the road to where the Allweg company had its corporate headquarters. And they did have several test tracks there, and this was one of the test trains. So very quickly, Walt came back from Germany, and he had conversations immediately with our people, and he sent Joe Fowler, who was manager of construction at Disneyland, sent them immediately to negotiate with the Allweg company in Germany. Meantime, Walt showed me photographs of the design of their train, and I thought it looked like something out of a German World War II bomber, you know, a not very attractive looking thing. And he says, well, Bobby, I want you to design the new monorail. And with words just as simple as that, I went to work trying to figure out how we're going to do this. We had already done the little Viewliner train, so there was a certain way that you could do the structural design and the passenger compartments. It was fairly simple, fairly straightforward. But I had to learn real quick about saddlebag straddle monorail, a type on a concrete beam. And I had about 2-3 days to absorb how that's done. Anyway, to make this train look good looking, we had to hide the fact that the monorail really is like a box with a slot in the bottom sitting on a stick. It's not really a very graceful thing. And I had to hide that beamway. Anyway, I remembered the Buck Rogers rocket ship of like the 1930s, where you had this pointed front, you had these splayed out sled runners where you could land on the planets, you know, and had a fin on the top and big rocket nozzle in the back, and had a wraparound windshield and portholes and Dr. Zarkov sitting up there driving it. And I thought, ah, oh, that's the style. That will hide the beamway. So that, sure, it's still a box sitting on a stick, but it's a pointy, streamlined, iconic-looking kind of a thing. And the sketch for that came about in about 10 minutes on my kitchen table one morning, because it was a clear vision of what would be the answer for that. But then, of course, within I think 2 to 2.5 weeks, I had to come up with enough structural design and a suspension design that we could make a few drawings and take with us to Germany when Roger Brogy, my boss, who would later be in charge of the manufacture of the trains, we went over to Germany to show them what we were going to design and engineer. Naturally, they were a professional company and wanted to design and build the monorail themselves for a famous client, Disneyland.
How dare you come with your own ideas?
Yes, you also got to remember that in Germany, you don't design anything and engineer anything unless you are a professional engineer. It's what's called diploma engineer, and everybody has this diploma on the wall. Well, I'm not a trained engineer. I'm an automobile stylist. I went to the Art Center College, and I had always fussed around with vehicles all my life. So you had a background knowledge of vehicle design. So what that meant was there really wasn't a secret that how you would design and engineer a monorail. It's just another vehicle to suit some kind of a interesting configuration. But anyway, we did convince the Germans it would be okay that this non-licensed ex-car stylist would design not only the styling but the engineering of it for this new monorail concept for Disneyland. Anyway, we had a fella come over here by the name of Conrad Deller, who was a German engineer, and he didn't come over to talk to us until we were actually constructing the monorail. And there were certain structural elements to do with the side rails and the frames that I had not quite gotten the design right. And Conrad Deller did some stress analysis and showed that we would have some high stress areas in the structure. So, but it was real simple. We just put a closure plate on it, so it was like a strange looking tube. That's all we had to change. So anyway, Conrad was very impressed with the fact that you can have a movie studio engineer monorail trains, and it looked like it was going to be okay. So we compromised with the Allweg company in that they weren't going to build it but they would be sort of responsible for the idea. And the lawyers for both companies agreed to put the name on the side of the train as the Disneyland Allweg monorail system. Even though Allweg did not build any of the train, they did build some parts called the side springs, which they wanted to have a little bit of piece of the action, so to speak. But within a few weeks, those parts began to fail immediately, so I redesigned the springs from a steel spring into a urethane spring so we could kind of adjust the side wheel settings on it. So it became an 100% Disney-designed, engineered, and built monorail carrying the Allweg name. So that's how the Allweg contributed to the early days of this train, with that idea that Walt saw matching up with that first sketch that was in the original Herb Ryman drawing. And that got us up to 1959 with monorail.
Well, now, how long was the entire process between when Walt came to you and said, or decided we're going to have a monorail, and it was opening day, so to speak?
From the first sketch at the first meeting until we gave Richard Nixon, Vice President of the United States, a ride, was 9 months.
Wow. Now, I understand that there's an interesting story related to Mr. Nixon.
Well, you know, Walt is so proud of anything he has that other people don't have. And this monorail just tickled him pink that he had something. He wanted to actually show it off to city mayors around the United States as here's a good answer for transit, a monorail, even though it's kind of a small version for Disneyland. So he was getting ready to, he wanted to show it to everybody. So his idea to really show it off was call his friend Dick to come over and bring his family and the girls come over here and give him have him dedicated. Now, he called him Dick, you know, they're close friends, of course. So anyway, we did 2 weeks of test and adjust on the train, and every night something broke, and we would redesign it during the night. A lot of it was electrical problems. So the night before the dedication, the train actually went around on its own without burning up or breaking down. So I parked it right in the station, knowing that the next day we're going to have live TV, we're going to have this dedication, ribbon cutting, and all the train has got to do is successfully drive out of the shot. Then it can break down. So with a honk of the horn, away we went, because we were sitting in the cab, and Walt said, gee, let's give him a ride. And I had the air conditioning on because it was very hot that day, and I was appalled that we were going to drive this train out of where we were going to dedicate it, knowing that it only worked one time the night before. So anyway, I drive out of the station, and in those days, the Beamway made a left turn, went back over the subway, or the submarine ride, and faced the monorail platform. When Vice President Nixon saw that all the Secret Service personnel were on the platform, that meant I just kidnapped the Vice President of the United States. Now, Nixon really enjoyed that ride, his wife and the girls. We came back around to the station again, and the Secret Service is running toward the train to get in it, and I'm going to stop. But the girls say, let's go again. And Walt says, Bobby, give him another ride. So I drove through the station where the guy's now running to try to jump in it. And I don't even remember the second trip because we hadn't planned on how to exit people from a burning monorail over the sub ride. We hadn't come to that part yet. So I was very distraught that, you know, now we've done two trips before we have to cut the ribbon. But anyway, we came back. Everybody jumps out of the train. We all walk down to off the little speed ramp at the end of the platform. And Nixon stops, turns and looks around. And all the Secret Service are sitting in the train. They're still not guarding the Vice President of the United States. Anyway, Nixon, as you know, he used a lot of four-letter words. And I can't repeat the adjectives that he used about his, what I call the palace guard. Now, watching all this thing is Conrad Deller, the German engineer that had come over to assist me with some of the design. He had come back for the opening test and adjust period. He's shaking in rage, and he's looking at me, and he says, Mr. Bob, we spend 7 million marks and 7 years to design the monorail, and we never let the public on it. you crazy Disneyland people. You get it running one night and you put your vice president on it. And the man was seriously enraged. But there was a distinction between how Germans would officially do something and how Disney would do things their way.
So not only the person involved in the creation of the monorail, but you've had the privilege of kidnapping the vice president. Well, now, I understand this morning you had a chance to see the new monorail, the Mark 7. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm very thrilled to see the Mark 7. Of course, I'd seen it with sketches a year and a half ago that Scott Drake had done to design it. Then I saw photographs on the Internet in December when the train was installed here. But today was the first time that I could actually see it in the flesh. And it was kind of a strange deja vu, because I well remember the 10-minute sketch on my kitchen table of the Buck Rogers type of style. Then to see that we evolved a number of different design trains from the 2, the 3, the 4, the 5, and the 6 that had kind of a Learjet look to it. But now when I saw this today, this was like going back 50 years. But Scotty took my basic feel, the basic theme of the design, and he brought it forward 50 years using modern materials and a lot better way of doing things for seating for the guests and interior lighting, a lot of stuff we didn't have in those days to do. So I'm probably the only person on the planet that can be totally tickled pink beyond anybody else's belief to see something that I'd sketched 50 years ago, which is a half a century ago, and see that theme repeated again. I can also chuckle to myself and brag to myself just a little bit that's the proof that if you're a good designer, the proof is 50 years later, somebody can't out-design you. So rather than have another design and another style, Scott elected to take that theme and build his new version of 2008 on top of the original theme.
Well, now, speaking of that, what does the monorail mean to you?
Well, to me, the monorail is it's such a Disneyland icon, because remembering this was something Walt had as a twinkle in his eye from the very first sketch that he had Herb Ryman draw. So in other words, the thoughts that originate in Walt's mind that eventually become Disneyland and, of course, everything else that Walt ever did, the fact that the monorail appeals instantly to the public, like it's up in the air and it's sleek and it's neat and it's mysterious and it's moving fast. Those were the things that Disneyland had in 1959. And I still read about and I still hear people tell me about what it was like when they were a little kid to see the monorail, and then what it was like to actually ride in the nose of the monorail. To them, it's an icon. To Walt, it was an icon. And today, it's probably become a super icon of everything to do with Disneyland. And that kind of basic design hopefully will go another 50 years.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Well, my pleasure.
We're now approaching the Tomorrowland Monorail Station, our final destination. Please remain seated until the monorail comes to a complete stop.
The new Mark 7 monorails pay homage to the very first Disneyland monorail, with a sleek design and familiar metallic finish on the outside of the train. Inside, a new seating configuration allows guests to face outward for a better view of the resort. And at night, an amazing lighting package gives the cabin interior a futuristic glow of blue neon. Scott Drake is the lead Imagineer for the new Mark 7 monorails. We caught up with him at the Disneyland monorail station to get a sneak peek of the new trains and to find out what goes into designing and building a state-of-the-art monorail train.
Well, I'm pleased to be joined now by Scott Drake. And Scott, what is it you do here with the Disneyland Resort?
I work for Walt Disney Imagineering as a principal concept designer, and right now we're really excited to show the new monorail Mark 7.
Well, now tell us a little bit about that. The Mark 7, so first of all, to put it all in context, this is a Mark 7. Obviously, some have come before, but can you kind of run through the history of the monorail real quickly?
Sure. The first monorail was 1959, called the Mark 1. And over the years, it's taken on different revisions, and they called them the Mark 2, obviously all the way up to the Mark 7. The current train, or the previous train before the Mark 7, was actually the Mark 5, because Mark 6 is in Florida, so that's the confusion there.
So now, as a park guest, what can I expect with the new monorail, the Mark 7?
Well, the new monorail Mark 7 is really inspired from the optimism of the original sketches from the Mark 1 in 1958 that Bob Gurr did. So it really has a sense of optimism and streamline design so that when this thing comes through the land, you're not going to miss it. There's a ton of color now in the monorail. It's really an icon for the park, and we're trying to get it as a great eye catcher for the park and the resort.
Well, now I understand it has kind of a special paint job. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's essentially like a hot rod paint job because it does have a very, very metallic color shift to it. So when this thing goes by, the highlight is just going to glow a really intense color. And sometimes you'll notice on train two, it might shift all the way from a blue to this great teal green.
Well, now, what is the process when something as iconic as the Disneyland monorail, when you're charged with redesigning it? First of all, it's got to be just an incredible honor.
It's definitely an honor, and at the beginning of a project like that, you're really searching for how are you going to make this thing unique, new, refreshed, but also keep in this Disney heritage that's been so strong here at the park.
What can you tell us about the process, and how long has this been going on?
We started this several years ago, and we started exploring what could a futuristic train look like, since it really does depart from Tomorrowland, and that's unique to all of our monorails around the world. Is this one started as an attraction, and it really is an extension of Tomorrowland throughout the resort. So we started saying, what is the most futuristic train? And really, we started looking a lot at that optimistic sketch of Bob Gurr and kind of the tradition that it's had here for so long, because it has to now go through Disney's California Adventure. It has to go through Downtown Disney. There's so many more places that you see it now, so that icon has to be just as strong as ever.
Well, now, the interior of the train is changing somewhat as well. Is that correct?
Yes. What I was really trying to do is make sure that the interior was just as streamlined as the exterior. If you've never been on the monorail before, but you've seen it as an icon in the park, your expectations when you go up and sit in it, that this should feel like you're inside of a private jet, or you're inside of this very streamlined, optimistic future travel. So we tried to elevate, you know, the expectations to be even greater with all new lighting underneath the seats and the seat back. There's what we're calling our jewel piece, which is a new logo that's in each cab that's going to be an edge-lit logo that's underlit. And this whole thing, we've been doing a lot of, you know, testing at night and seeing it at night. This whole interior glows the color of the windows. So we're really excited for people to see the new interior.
So it sounds like kind of when you board the monorail, you kind of get a sense that you're boarding, kind of walking into the future a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think as much as we can play up that fantasy, plus, you know, the interior, it should be a wow when you get in there, but it also, we've changed the seating configuration because the reason you ride the monorail is to get the greatest views of the park. From elevated up above, you get to see things that you couldn't otherwise do. So the focus once the ride gets going is much larger windows, and from the exterior, it's going to look like big streamlined windows instead of segmented, so the windows and the scene into the park is really what the attraction is about.
Now, also from an ecological point of view, I understand the monorail is pretty kind of eco-friendly. Is that right?
Oh yeah, this has been something, and it's not new to the Mark 7. It's been since the Mark 1 an electric vehicle, and we tried to even plus that up by all the lighting except for the headlights are all LED headlights, so it's a very green vehicle.
Well, now you were talking a little bit also about how's the styling unique. I mean, is it exactly the same train, or is it sounds like it's got a new look to it?
It's inspired, but an evolution. If you look at, I like to compare it to, you know, great design like a Porsche or I compared it when. If you look at the VW Beetle, it had a classic, iconic look to it, but the older one, you know, had recessed windows and big mullions. When they when they redid the newer one, it's all the same iconic shape, but done in new ways and new materials and flush glass. And we're trying to do that same thing, bring the new materials into this classic design sense.
Well, I mean, for you personally, what's it feel like to work on something as integral to the Disneyland Resort as the monorail?
Well, it's definitely been a great design challenge, a huge honor, and definitely something that is very intimidating because there's so much legacy. Everyone has their own personal experience with the monorail and what it means to them, and trying to capture that and carry on that tradition is a huge thing on all of our backs that we're working on, that are all working on this. But it's a small team of people, and it's been a great ride to see this whole thing through. And now seeing it with getting to the park, it's an amazing circle to see from a sketch to reality.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today, Scott.
Great, thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the year of a million dreams. In just a few minutes, Disneyland will proudly welcome Walt Disney's Parade of Dreams. Join us for this dream-filled celebration beginning in just a few minutes. Thank you.
Recognize that voice? You might not know who it is, but chances are you've heard that voice again and again here at the Disneyland Resort. His name is Bill Rogers, and he is one of several artists who have lent their voices to create a bit of the magic here at the Disneyland Resort. We caught up with Bill and asked him about his role and the history of the voice of Disneyland. Well, I'm pleased now to be joined by Bill Rogers. And Bill, people are going to probably recognize this, but why don't you tell us what it is you do here at the Disneyland Resort?
Well, Michael, my job is to go, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, in just 5 minutes, Disneyland proudly presents, and fill in the blank after that.
So I guess people would call you the current voice of Disneyland.
That would probably be a good title. It's been passed around a couple of times by a couple of different people, but yes, indeed, that's what I do. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what's kind of the history behind the voiceovers here at the Disneyland Resort?
Once upon a time, I was in a recording session down in Newport Beach, California, with a fellow by the name of Thurl Ravenscroft. Now, for those of you who don't know Thurl's name, he's the guy who went for years, "They're great!" He was the voice of Tony the Tiger. And I said, "You know, Thurl, have you ever met Jack Wagner, who, you know, was the guy who basically came up with the phrase, the voice of Disneyland, and because he was?" And Thurl goes, "Wait a minute, I was the voice of Disneyland first." And I got to thinking about it. Thurl is the guy that you hear on the train going, "Hello, folks." You know, if you wandered into the old Country Bear Jamboree, Thurl was the voice of Buff the Buffalo. And if you go to the Haunted Mansion, Thurl is one of the four guys singing, "Grim Grinning Ghosts Come Out to Socialize." You know, great singer on top of that, and just an amazing narrator. So Thurl, I guess when it comes right down to it, was the very first voice of Disneyland, and he was followed by this incredible jazz disc jockey who at one time had a magnificent show on KHJ Radio in Los Angeles before they made it rock and roll and called it 93 KHJ. But Jack was this wonderful kind of spoken word jazz disc jockey. And he went from there to working with a fellow by the name of Ozzie Nelson, who with his wife had a TV show called Ozzie and Harriet. Jack was the guy who was the soda jerk. He was a recurring character that, you know, when Ozzie and Rick went down to the malt shop, there was Jack. When the show ended, Ozzie went to his friend Walt Disney and said, "You know, I got this guy who has a great voice. I really would like you to meet him. I think you guys could, you know, do something here." And Walt and Jack Wagner got together and created what is now called the position of voice of Disneyland. But Jack was the voice not only of Disneyland, he was the voice of Disney World, he was the voice of Tokyo Disneyland as well for a number of years. He created this incredible aura that is part charm, part glamour, and part just good old-fashioned family joy. And put it all into one voice, and it was that voice that I heard over the years and said, you know, like everybody says to me these days, "Boy, I really want that guy's job." You know? Jack retired at the ripe old age of 69, and a couple of months later, unfortunately, passed away. All of us miss him. these days, if you come to Disneyland and if you go to the Magic Kingdom at Disney World, you will hear, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Disneyland or Disney World Railroad now leaving." That's Jack Wagner. He's also the guy who says, "Keep your hands and arms inside the car all the time over at the Matterhorn." Only he says it in Espanol. That's Jack. And for years, he has been all things to all people when it comes to Disneyland. And it was my job to try and fill those immense shoes. I'm not sure that I'm ever going to be able to do it, because what Jack did for this park was something that no other announcer has ever done for any other park.
Well, it's kind of interesting, you know, as a voice professional, it's interesting to hear you describe what you think somebody else is doing, what's right about it. And in Jack's case, I think you kind of summed that up very nicely when you were talking about putting the family and the good fun into that voice.
Yeah, he set the standard for all of the people that really wanted to do this job.
Well, now, do many voice professionals come out of radio? I mean, what's your background?
I started in radio as well at the ripe old age of 13 in a little town in South Dakota. Indeed, most of the people in this business started at one time or another in some other form of entertainment. And most of the time it was radio, because radio was the one thing that when you were growing up, you could always do. You know, it didn't make any difference how old you were, because you didn't make any difference whether you looked like a kid or not. You could sound like anything you wanted to be, and that was the way you grew up.
Well, now, what was your experience, and your introduction to being the voice of Disneyland?
A wonderful lady that I once knew, when I came to California back in the mid-80s. Now, I had gone to school at the University of Southern California when I was a kid. When I came back here in the mid-80s, I met and talked with a lovely lady who said, "One of these days I'm going to be able to do something nice for you." And I said, "Fine." Well, she introduced me to the guy who was looking for the replacement for Jack. Although I didn't know this, I was a guy who was doing radio commercials in Southern California, and this lady, she and her husband owned an edit facility, and they brought this new fella in that they had known for a number of years. They brought this new fella in and said, can you do some stuff for us on top of all the things you already do for Disneyland? Because he, and this fellow's name is Paul Freeman, he and Don Dorsey, along with Jack, created a lot of the things that are very memorable in this park, including the Main Street Electrical Parade. So, long story short, I come over to see the equipment. I have no idea who Paul Freeman is. He says, "What do you think about Jack Wagner?" And I said, "The man is my hero. I'm in love with what he does." And he says, "Well, that's what I'd heard, and I really would like you to try this." And it was the introduction in those days. This was 1991. It was the introduction to the Main Street Electrical Parade. And I said, "You're kidding." He goes, "No." And I said, so I went into the booth and went, "Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls." And I came out of the booth, and the guy says, Paul says to me, he says, "I don't make these decisions by myself." But he says, "By Thursday, you're probably going to hear that you're the new voice of Disneyland." And I walked about 4 feet off the floor out of the building. So that's how this all began. But it came from the fact that over the years, I've been to Disneyland. I live in Orange County, and I had been to the park so many times and spent a whole lot of extra time sitting out at the ticket booths listening to Jack's spiel about Disneyland will be open today from now till midnight, and you can get 2-day or 3-day park hopper passes. Wait a minute, there was no park hopper in those days. There was park passes, yes, but nonetheless, that's the way it worked.
But you also, you do many of the recorded messages here, but you also come out for a lot of the special events and do those live.
I do, and every once in a while. I have no doubt that one of these days we're going to do a really big deal. Somebody's going to win one of the really huge Year of a Million Dreams prizes, and they're going to be in the parade, and I'm going to actually wander over and go, "Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tonight our grand prize winner in the Year of a Million," something like that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And I do that and got a chance to really get into doing that a lot during Disney's 50th anniversary. And that really was a whole lot of fun. Now, as it is, I spend most of my time pre-recording these announcements. But I get a chance to show up in the park and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, Disney legend Julie Andrews." They just dedicated a carousel horse not too long ago. And it was just a gas. I get a chance to introduce all these really cool people that I grew up with.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us
today.
Pleasure.
I want you to know that this is the greatest job on the planet. You know, the kind of things that happen at Disneyland, the magic that happens here every day, makes me want to come back day after day, year after year. And it really is an awful lot of fun. Thanks for the chance.
Well, that'll just about do it for this edition. If you enjoyed the show, please feel...
Michael?
Oh, Bill.
I really would like to... You've been doing this for a long time, and I don't get a chance to do very much except inside the park. So, if you wouldn't mind.
But by all means.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that'll just about do it for this edition. If you enjoyed the show, please feel free to share it with a friend. And remember, we have both audio and video podcasts available at disneyland.com/podcasts. Or in the iTunes podcast directory, where we also appreciate feedback. And while you're there, be sure to check out the newest video podcast. Until next time, I'm Bill Rogers.
And I'm Michael Gohagan.
Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you for listening to the Disneyland Resort Podcast. And don't forget to join us next month as we continue to celebrate the power of dreams during Disney's Year of a Million Dreams.